Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash. And with us today, we have Dave Real. Dave is the host of Developer on Fire. He's also first and foremost a father of three wonderful children. He's a husband, podcaster, software developer, and architect, and delights in matters technical and in human interaction. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks very much, John. I'm glad to be here.
So, Dave, you and I chatted some on the Developer on Fire Facebook group. It's a fantastic community you have there. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Oh, sounds good. Yeah, I've been doing the podcast thing for, almost a couple years. I guess it's a little bit shy of that. Started in 2015 and just loving it. I had the idea that I like a lot of the technical podcasts I listen to, but the thing I thought was missing was sharing the human element of software development. So I wanted to find stories, right? Just get people to share their stories, their experiences, their wisdom. And I think it's really worked out really well. More about me, right? The bio says a lot about it, you know, that I'm a dad. That's the thing that is the biggest deal to me in the world. And playing with those little people that kind of look like me are, you know, that's my greatest joy in life. And I've been doing software for a long time, started in 1999 when all you needed to become a software developer was, you know, if you had some blood pressure, I think they'd give you a software developer job in those days and during the dot-com boom. And so, you know, I've been around for a while and seen a lot of things and just love doing software. And, you know, the recent discovery that I've had from doing the podcast is that I used to tell myself this story that I'm good with machines, but not good with humans. And I've switched that. I had now realized that, hey, I'm good at both. And I think that's the biggest lesson that I've learned over this whole journey.
Other than the podcast, what else have you been up to?
So I recently did a remote conference event related to the podcast, and that was cool. I got a lot of really awesome speakers to come and give pre-recorded talks, right? They put some careful preparation into doing these talks and then had some Q&A sessions during the event. And so that was kind of a big thing that consumed the last few months of me, my efforts on that. So that was a good time. Beyond that, right, doing contract software development here and there, and attending meetups, and you know, just getting around and getting more and more into conferences. That's something that I haven't done for a majority of my career, but I'm really, really digging that. The experience I had at the Kansas City Developer Conference, especially last summer, was just epic. You know, a lot of the people that I've talked to on the podcast, I got to shake their hands. We're not just Skype friends anymore, right? I've actually got to meet them face to face, and that was such a treat.
That sounds awesome.
Absolutely.
So technology-wise, what's been your main point of focus these days?
Well, .NET Core is the thing that's got me most interested. The fact that this technology that used to be limited to Windows is now open to pretty much any platform that you want. And the things that enables is really cool. So I've been a .NET developer my whole career, kind of by accident. Nick Molnar was on Developer on Fire, and we talked a little bit about how the technology kind of chooses the developer, which I kind of liken to in Harry Potter, right? Mr. Ollivander telling Harry, hey, the wand chooses the wizard. And I think, you know, it was kind of happenstance that early in my career, I was working with Microsoft stuff. And so I just kind of went down that path. So, but yeah, .NET is kind of my bread and butter. I mean, of course, everybody's got to know something about JavaScript these days. So, you know, being exposed to Node a bit and, you know, learning about, React and Angular and all of that kind of stuff is, you know, I mean, nobody can escape all of that kind of stuff. So I'm really enjoying React and liking that as well. But, I think .NET is still, C# is the place I always come back to.
All right. So when John was talking to you about coming on the show, it sounded like you wanted to talk a little about domain-driven design. And it sounds like you might have a slightly different definition than some other people we may have talked to. Why don't you start by telling us some of the key concepts from your perspective for DDD?
Sure. So I think a lot of times when you hear about domain-driven design, you hear about some of the what von Verden calls the tactical patterns, as opposed to the strategic patterns. And so I think, you know, that's where you get into these things, the aggregate routes and the entities and all of the kind of stuff that is kind of the low level how-tos that Eric Evans had in that book, the domain-driven design book. And I think those things are interesting, but they're not the core thing. They're not why domain-driven design is interesting. The strategic patterns, I think, are the things that are really a lot more interesting. And that's why when I had Eric Evans on the show, right? I mean, and what a treat for me that I got to have the author of this book, right? The creator of domain-driven design on my show. And I got to test some of my assumptions, some of the things that I thought about it against his thinking and got to talk to him. And he really emphasized modeling. And he also talked on the show about how he included a lot of that low-level stuff in the book because a lot of these kind of timeless principle books, these architectural pattern kinds of books that are out there, they don't really get as much of, they don't get as much buy-in. They don't get people as interested in them if there's not some code in the books, right? So he thought that was kind of a crucial element, that it had to go all the way from the concept down into implementation for it really to take hold. But that's really not the core of the thing. The most important things in domain-driven design, and I kind of have a few bullet points that I think are the most interesting things, right? But the two things, kind of the fundamental foundations of it are, one, speaking the language of the domain. Eric calls this the ubiquitous language in the book. And this is the thing that's really, I think, the foundation, the linchpin that makes everything else go in domain-driven design, is that instead of having these meetings where the business people talk about, here's what we want the thing to do, and then going away and translating that into tech, it's bringing those conversations together so that we're all speaking the same language. And I think that's something that's missing in most of the things that we do in software development. I'm subscribed to Jonathan Stark's email list, and he's the hourly billing is nuts guy, right? And so he's got all this stuff there about ways to deal with business and all of those kinds of things. And he recently sent out a mailing where it was talking about that he has this problem with socks, where his feet don't fit the socks right because he has bigger than normal feet, and that socks tend to go down into his shoes. And so he wanted to do something different with his socks, and it turns out that his wife is a knitter, right? And so he was having this conversation with her about knitting socks, and that she was talking about all of these technical things about knitting that he didn't know anything about. And he's just like, hey, I just don't want my socks to go into my shoes, right? I don't care about the ribbing of the fabric, or I don't remember the details of all that stuff because it was stuff that didn't mean anything to me. And I think it's the same thing in our conversations with our domain experts, our businesses, the people that know something about the problem we're trying to solve. Is that when we start talking about HTTP status codes, and we start talking about forms and posts and AJAX and all of this kind of stuff, well, we just lose them, and it's not interesting stuff. Talking about the actual problem in the terms that those people use, well, that's the way that we can move forward on trying to understand what it is we're actually trying to accomplish and get out of this world of the tech. So I think that's kind of the one pillar of this thing. The other is the idea of bounded context. And I think we can get into more into that.
I think I remember the episode where Eric Evans was on your show speaking about that. He mentioned things that in recent conversations I've had with current and former coworkers about DDD, people are really concerned about definitions and whether or not what they're working on are fitting definitions, and less so focused on are they doing the right thing for their client, for their business, for the application that they're developing. Do you find that that's the case as well, or how have you found the conversations around DDD with others in the industry?
Well, I think the best way to deal with approaching DDD concepts is to never, ever, ever say DDD, right? To never talk and say that, hey, we're going domain-driven design here or anything like that. It's just bringing in the ideas from domain-driven design, speaking the language of the domain. Even saying ubiquitous language can trigger some people to have some emotional reactions to, oh, you're talking about those aggregates and that stuff, right? It's for some of the technical people in operations. It's usually better to just get down to, hey, these terms that we're using, right? I can remember that I worked in a business where there were a whole bunch of acquisitions from different businesses that were doing the same things in similar ways, but different ways, right? And terms that would mean one thing in one of these businesses meant something completely different in a different place. And so just getting down to this point where we are using the same words to mean the same thing and just having conversations about, well, what does that term mean, right? Asking lots and lots of questions, I think, is the approach that makes a lot more sense. But yeah, when people start talking about whatever it is, right, whether we're talking about microservices or we're talking about behavior-driven development or any of those kinds of things, you know, the idea of, well, am I doing this right? Am I there, right? Am I using these terms correctly? Well, that becomes a bit more of a religious question than anything practical. Dispensing with the terms and kind of going about, well, what's the best way forward is often a better path than trying to you know, get into the rigor of following the dogma or anything like that.
Yeah, it's like nobody does rest correctly.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
But you shouldn't be. You should be doing the thing that's best for the situation that you're programming to, not necessarily rest.
Absolutely.
So I think you've mentioned several of the key terms involved in DDD. Do you want to go a little bit more in depth in giving a brief definition of some of these things with a little bit more of that caution to not be so dogmatic about some of the definitions?
Sure. I think that makes sense. I think the important one, right, the thing that I mentioned there at the end of talking about the ubiquitous language is bounded context. And I think that's the other key feature of domain-driven design that really makes it what it is. These other things, I think, are more implementation details. And even beyond that, more of a reference implementation than really necessarily the implementation of domain-driven design. So I think before getting into some of those terms, I'd start with bounded context, which I think is an important concept and something that, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily use the term domain-driven design, but they do talk about things like service-oriented architecture or microservices, which to me, I think are synonymous. I think there's some more specificity in microservices, but I know I just set off a religious debate there, right? About, you know, what are the meaning of these terms, right? But I think at its core, right, when you think about microservices, one of the things that I think, and it depends on who you listen to, because microservices mean something different to everybody, but the core tenet is that these services are autonomous. And I think that the idea that you have a service is not only an HTTP endpoint, right? It's not just some REST API, but that it encapsulates its own data and that you're not sharing data among these services. I think that's one of the key tenets of microservices that, well, is often overlooked, right? I think most of the time where I've gone into an engagement and people are talking about microservices, they're just saying, well, we're just going to have a whole bunch of independent processes that are serving HTTP endpoints and we're all talking to the same database, which I think that kind of goes against the idea of what microservices are. But despite all that, right, and despite the wrestling over the definition of terms that we just talked about as being not that important, right, I think that idea of autonomy that I think is core to microservices is the idea of what it is that's important about bounded contexts. Udi Dhawan is kind of the guy that first introduced me to the idea of domain-driven design was through his interpretation of service-oriented architecture. And he defined service as being the technical authority for a business capability, which I think if you think about that, right, instead of thinking, well, hey, it's an HTTP endpoint or some of those things, right? And service is a terribly overloaded term that we use to mean all kinds of different things. But with Udi's definition there, right, it's the technical authority, I think talks about some of that that encapsulation, that autonomy that you might have in a given service. And I think that's one of the big takeaways for me of what this bounded context thing is that within this context, right, it's fully encapsulated. And if I use my ubiquitous language within this bounded context, then I can know what I'm talking about. I can deal with a subset of the problem, and I don't need to necessarily worry about dependencies to other services, ideally. And I think it would take a lot longer than the time we have in this show to really get into what that means and how that autonomy is achieved and all of those kinds of things. But I think that's one of the important things there is a composition of your system into things that have autonomy.
And I think you've started to touch on many of these. Are there any other misconceptions that you see frequently?
Well, I think sure. I mean, there are a lot of other terms that come up when you start talking about domain-driven design, right? There's a lot of enthusiasm for things like CQRS, command query responsibility segregation in domain-driven design communities. And I think that might give the impression that these things are synonymous, which they're not necessarily, right? I think CQRS is one tool that you can use in a domain-driven design context, and it's a good one. And there's a lot of reasons to use CQRS. It's also not for every situation. And I think there are a lot of, getting into what is CQRS, you know, and when is it applicable, and all of those kinds of things. It's another one of those, you know, it's a subject for full length courses, you know, and something that we can't get into here, right? And, you know, with CQRS, then people start talking about event sourcing, which is also one of those things that is, you know, It's a tool that is useful. It's a great way to think about modeling your domain. But it's not necessarily, you know, the bread and butter of what DDD is all about. I like to say that I think of, you know, for those of us who have used, you know, the C++ like languages like C Sharp and Java and all of those kinds of things, right? I think of it, you know, I think of domain-driven design as an interface. And you can implement that in a lot of ways. And among those ways of implementing it are service-oriented architecture, microservices. And you know, and within your bounded context, you might have implementations like the things that Eric has around aggregates and value objects and entities and all of that stuff. And that's one example of one of those reference implementations of ways that you might approach things to actually implement within one of those bounded contexts.
It seems like that bounded context should be solving a problem, and the tools that are being used to solve that problem should be driven based on the problem, and not just simply some sort of dogmatic style that you're kind of imposing.
Absolutely. And they could be even completely different tech stacks, completely different approaches, all kinds of different ways within each of these different bounded contexts. And I think that's part of the beauty of this thing is that when you really have that autonomy, then, you know, it's just completely separate teams. And I think that's where these kinds of things like domain-driven design make the most sense is when you're in large organizations where you have multiple teams that are working on different subsets of the problem. If you can align your teams along those business capabilities and give them autonomy to solve their own problems and deploy independently, test independently, and all of those kinds of things, then that's a big win. And you really have a composition of sub problems that can be put together to make an overall solution.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're kind of getting into this. So why does this really matter? What really are the benefits? You kind of began there.
Well, I think that's it, right? That you can decompose your, well, the of these two big pillars that I'm talking about, right? One, the ubiquitous language, well, that just is pure communication, right? You're able to understand the problem that you're dealing with better. And in fact, Dan North in his blog post that introduced behavior-driven development, right? Which is really at its core, the idea of behavior-driven development is about understanding the problem. It's about describing your system with behaviors, with examples of how the thing should work. In that blog post where he introduced the concept, he quoted domain-driven design and was talking about establishing a ubiquitous language. So that idea of using the right language to understand your problem, I think speaks for itself, right? It's a communication tool. And so that's really important. And the bounded context thing, I think it just simplifies the way that you can approach your system, and you can, you know, the old adage of how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time, right? That you can take those bites independently without having this is kind of where I think that there's a role for architects, right? There's kind of this question that has been going around of does Agile kill the need for architects? And I think for systems where you have one team, it probably does. But in larger systems where you've got multiple teams operating on things, then it makes sense to have an architect who has an eye on the bigger picture and how these teams interact with one another and keeping things moving in that direction. And so that then these teams can just deal with the problem that they have at hand. And that's where this bounded context idea really shines, is that the teams can focus on the problem that they have to solve and not have to worry so much about where they fit in. With the exception of, you know, having some input onto where the operations should go as a whole, of course, right? I mean, you want that participation, but they are able to focus in and you can kind of look at things at different levels of abstraction.
Our listeners are mostly, if not 100% developers. So when they hear this podcast, they're going to possibly get jazzed about going and doing some DDD. Would you say that at your typical corporate environment, which most C# developers find themselves in, do you think that the architect would be more likely the one to run DDD up the corporate flagpole, or how could a team developer introduce or push for some of the concepts, whether they name them or not? How could they push for some of the concepts to be adopted and used by the company they're working at?
I think that's a good question, and it's going to depend on the organization, right? If you are in an organization where there is an architect, that's probably a person who's making some decisions about how things are approached in this organization. So talking to that person would probably be an obvious choice. I think beyond that, though, you're going to be in meetings with some business stakeholders and some of those things. And it's not that hard to start to ask questions about the terms that they use when they're describing what their life is like. And so going that route of understanding the terms that they use and using those in the code, as opposed to talking about, you know, hey, I've got some service endpoint or something along those lines, and talking about, error conditions and that kind of stuff. You can start to talk about things that the business actually cares about. And I think that that's just something that, without having to push for domain-driven design at all, is something that you can just start to do. Now, if you've got managers in the organization and those kinds of things, then talking to them about some autonomy in these things, and pushing for that, if we can operate independently without having a whole bunch of dependencies on needing to have one team finish their work and then deploy these things in tandem and all of those kinds of things, right? I think most developers are familiar with the pain of having coordinated rollouts of multiple pieces of systems and having to think about all of that kind of stuff. And it enables a lot of the DevOps things that we talk about with, that's another term, right? That can mean a lot of things. And I'm abusing the term a little bit to talk about, things like continuous integration, continuous deployment, right? You have a lot more capability of doing those things when you gain some autonomy among the pieces of your system. So there's a benefit there that you can push with your architects, managers, and even business stakeholders if you have to make some cases for making some changes to those things. And ideally, you don't have to convince them about how to do your job, right? The technical stuff is in your field. But I mean, every organization is different, and who you have to convince is different. But I think that talking about some of these benefits of being able to do things independently will have some sway with a lot of people.
Going to your comment about asking questions in some of those business meetings, along the lines of those people skills that you alluded to early on in our discussion, it's pretty easy to see that business folks or people that are involved in other parts of the business really appreciate when someone comes to them and asks about their job and about how to make their lives better and truly shows an interest in getting the language correct and getting the terms correct and figuring out the processes. You're really going to see a lot of excitement from others in other areas of the business.
It's age-old dating advice that you don't sit down at the table to have dinner with your date and just talk about yourself, right? So I think that's intuitive in a lot of ways. Saranyat Barak, who is the does the Code Newbie podcast and the Code Newbie community, she was on my show, and she said something that I think I realized, but I didn't really consciously grasp it, and I couldn't articulate it until she said it. She talked about that being a podcaster, that when she interviews people, and the whole focus of the show is to get them to talk about themselves, them to share the things that they're excited about, to talk about their interests, that is just a natural for getting people to feel connected to you. And it's an interesting side effect of being a podcaster. And when she said that, it totally resonated with me that, being a podcaster myself, that that's absolutely right. And so I think it's a really good point there. When you walk in and talk about the things that a business person cares about, yes, you are establishing and making a relationship a lot more intimate and growing a real human connection with another person. And that benefits with you in a lot of ways.
So one issue that I have seen, and this may not be wholly related, but I think that it does have some relation. We kind of talk about like talking about the problem in the language of the business and the domain language. One issue that I've seen is that oftentimes, or many times, and I don't know if it's because the technical people always kind of talk in their tech talk, but the business comes to the technical people with the solution instead of bringing them the problem. And so there isn't we skip the whole opportunity to talk about the problem because the whole conversation begins with, this is the solution that we need. Do you have any advice, or can you speak to that at all?
Well, I think that's something that is hard, right? And yes, that is real. And I think everybody thinks they're an expert at coming up with the solution. I think part of that is just the natural ego that we all have as human beings. And part of it is that like you said, the business people think they need to translate into the domain of tech because the tech people aren't going to understand their domain. So I think the establishing a precedent of, hey, I can speak the language of the business is probably step zero on that. And the asking of questions is the other thing that, you know, we talked about that, that that's kind of how you learn about the language of the domain. But at the same time too, right? I mean, that's when somebody comes to you and says, hey, I need a grid on my web page and it needs to be editable with all of these things, right? And it needs to work in, you know, this browser and needs to have these calls back to the server, right? And yeah, business people are going to tell you that kind of stuff. Asking questions is the way to get deeper on that, right? It's well, and that, you know, that ever important question, right? Of all the questions, the most important one is always why. And, you know, I think there's a reason that toddlers have this annoying habit of why on everything, right? And I think it's not that they're just annoying. It's really insightful. And it's, you know, somebody who's curious about the world around them and wants to know more about it, which is exactly what a toddler is. You know, I think we can learn something from those little people. So I think, you know, always digging deeper on whys. You know, the practice of five whys, which I think came out of Lean and Toyota and some of that stuff. I'm not completely sure about that, but that is you know, a very appealing practice, right? At risk of, you know, being annoying to the people that you're talking to, right? I think that's probably the biggest risk of it. But always digging deeper and trying to figure out why. Well, then, you know, then the explanation for that why. Well, why on that? And you know, you ultimately get down to a point where, you know, the recursion ends and you've gotten to a point where you learn something from it.
Right. I want to throw in there that you may not want to implement it as why?
Yeah.
Why?
Indeed.
Use a leading question that will force them to answer the why, but without, you know, without always saying just why, because eventually you'll run into, because I said so.
Yes, as toddlers will tell you.
But that's the adage, though, isn't it? Ask why five times or something.
Yeah, that's the gist of the five whys practice.
Do you have any advice for up-and-coming developers who might have their sights on becoming a six-figure dev themselves?
Before I started being a podcaster, my advice would have been very different than it is today. I think I've learned a lot from interacting with some of the luminaries of our field and getting into some of this, well, hey, maybe I'm a little more human than I thought, kind of an attitude. So I think really the biggest thing that you can do to advance your career, to become a six-figure developer or beyond that, right, to advance yourself, is to work on your human skills. I think, you know, the tech skills are of critical importance, and you need to be the best developer you can be to be that six-figure developer. But it's a lot more valuable. And this is something that Matt Wynn said when he was on my show, that that he found kind of a niche for himself as being somebody who could translate between the language of the business and the language of the developers. And that is the thing that is invaluable. And that's where you are going to advance your career, where you're going to be able to move forward, get some new opportunities and all of those kinds of things. So if you are focused purely on being the best JavaScript guy that there is out there, well, for one thing, that's impossible, right? I mean, unless you're LeBron James, you can't be LeBron James, right? So that's one thing that's probably not going to be the path to fame and recognition and all of those things. But if you are able to ask those why questions and dig down into the true nature of the problem, express that in ways that your business people can understand and turn that into technology, well, you know, there's a minimum competence that you need in tech to be able to get to there. But the exploring what it's like to talk to people, right? And I think, you know, there's a lot of ways you can develop those skills. And I think chief among them is getting engaged in communities, right? Go to meetups, speak at meetups, go to conferences, right? Submit to those talks, get in front of people and, you know, just do that thing to improve your social skills, which is just practice it. Keep practicing, keep working on it, maybe even start a podcast, right? I think that's been a thing that has really helped me. So, you know, just getting engaged is probably the best advice that I can give.
Along those lines, do you have any upcoming speaking engagements or other announcements?
I do, actually. I am going to be speaking at IndieCode in April, which is in Indianapolis, Indiana. So I'm really looking forward to that. I know it's organized by some people that I got to interact with at KCDC and some of those things, and they've been guests on my podcast. So yeah, really looking forward to connecting with some old friends and making some new ones there. I also have, you know, I mentioned that I did this Developer on Fire remote conference, and I have the talks from that, the question and answer sessions are recorded, and Slack interaction from the event and all of that. And I'm kind of repackaging that into an information product. So I think, you know, You may have missed the event itself and are not going to be able to interact and ask your questions of these amazing luminaries that gave these talks in this thing. But I've got that as an information product. And the title I'm still kind of working out, but it's going to be something along the lines of develop yourself to develop your career. So it includes a lot of these soft skills kinds of things, the human interaction, the human side of your career that is really important. So I've got that. It's going to be available at developyourself.developeronfire.com. So, or if that's not the title that it lands on, then at least that'll redirect or something along the lines. That'll get you there. So that thing's out there and available, and I think a lot of people could benefit from that.
So how can others get in touch with you?
Well, I think the easiest way is probably Twitter. That's the thing that I'm out there. That's my last name, Rael Yard. So RaelYard. You can get a hold of me there. And that's always easy. Developeronfire.com is the site for the podcast and my what has been mostly inactive blog, but it's going to be ramping up here soon. And links for being able to support the show and join that Facebook community that you talked about, John. And actually, that's probably a good one to connect with there. Facebook.com/developeronfire is the community. Folks can come and interact with myself and a lot of other listeners, and a lot of guests of the show are appearing in there as well.
All right, Dave, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks a lot, guys. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Good talking to you, too. If you enjoyed this episode of Six Figure Developer Podcast, be sure to like, rate, and review us. Also, follow us on Twitter at Six Figure Dev.
That was Dave Rael. Dave is the host of Developer on Fire Podcast. He's first and foremost a father of three wonderful children. Dave is also a husband, podcaster, software developer, and architect, and delights in matters technical and in human interaction. This has been the Six Figure Developer Podcast. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.